Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome to December. Hope you've had a good day so far. Glad to have you plug in with us today. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls, Carissa Rogers at the phones. And Ted, we do want to just remind folks that December is a time when we do a partnership with Angel Tree Prison Fellowship. And so we're going to hear a powerful story here a bit later in the show about somebody whose lives has been impacted because of the Angel Tree Ministry.
It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to reach out to kids that are missing their parents because their parents are in prison. So you'll hear more about it. But yeah, I'm also excited to get my Advent calendar out now and start turning windows open.
Sure. Okay.
Look for chocolate.
Okay. Yes. Well, so yes, you've got the right motivation, I think. So, well, today is, as we mentioned, December, but this is a day that's been designated as World AIDS Day over the last number of years. And it's been a while since we've talked about this disease that, according to statistics I'm just looking at this morning, over 36 million people worldwide living with HIV/AIDS as of the end of last year. An estimated 2.1 million individuals worldwide became newly infected with HIV in 2015. Of those, 150,000 were children 15 years and younger. In fact, almost 2 million of those infected with HIV/AIDS are 15 years old or younger, which is just a sad thing. Most of these children live in sub-Saharan Africa and were infected by their HIV-positive mothers during pregnancy, childbirth, or breastfeeding. And currently, only 60% of people with HIV know their status. These are some sobering statistics. We're going to talk HIV/AIDS today and more. We'll get into talking about Syria and the refugee crisis and about the possibilities, how we can maybe change the world and do it in a new, clearer way. Glad to have back with us today Stephen Bauman, is President and CEO of World Relief. They're a church-based international relief and development agency. And in that role, Bauman oversees programs in health, economics, agriculture, and refugee assistance in countries around the globe. And he's an ordained minister. And he and his wife are living in Baltimore now, where World Relief is headquartered. But he's a Wisconsin native. In fact, got some education at the University of Wisconsin. And so we always love talking with one of our own. Stephen, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you, Neil. Thank you so much.
You know, I want to just jump in, talk about the AIDS epidemic, and it does seem like, just as I was kind of going through some of those statistics, that once again, children are the ones who suffer the most. Whether, you know, it doesn't seem, you know, they're not at fault, but they suffer the most of the disease, it seems like. And I'm wondering, is that a reoccurring reality for ministries like World Relief, that you're always dealing with the most vulnerable who are suffering kind of through no fault of their own?
Well, it's true. I mean, children are sort of a litmus test for a community. How well are the children doing is often a question of myself and my colleagues when I travel the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa, where AIDS is, you know, HIV/AIDS is still a major issue there. I know we don't hear about it as much as we used to. And part of the reason that we don't hear about it is because the faith community put their faith to action in amazing ways globally and in Africa, and there's been major progress. But still, like you say, Neil, there are many children suffering from HIV/AIDS, and there are some pretty proven solutions now to prevent transmission from the mother to the child. And again, there's so many faith communities that are doing great things, but there's so much more that can be done.
You know, I heard Rick Warren say some time ago, he said that the global church is uniquely positioned to be the solution to many of these world-class problems because they're living and working in the communities where the need is greatest. Is that what you found as well? That, I mean, as you said, the churches have really been stepping up and playing a significant role.
It's true. I mean, you think about the largest social network, spiritual network in the world. It's the global church, you know, 2 billion plus people. And a church is not only present in so many parts of the world, but present right where the people are, in rural parts, places that are far and hard to reach. And then thirdly, the churches have the trust of the community, by and large, whether it's the pastors or the staff or the lay leaders, the elders. So there's a trust relationship there. And you know, back to your question about HIV/AIDS, it was the sea change in the sub-Saharan Africa church from not wanting to talk about AIDS to being willing to talk about it that really began sort of the major shift in bringing services and help and openness and then prevention of AIDS for communities, people, young people especially. So the church has always been, you know, from my own personal calling, it's my laser focus is on the church and recognizing the church is never perfect. None of our churches are perfect. And yet I do believe the church is often at its best when it's in action, when it's outside its walls, serving the community in need.
You know, I think probably most of our churches in this country weren't really interested in having conversation about HIV/AIDS either. But was it just simply because, I mean, in terms of the African church, that the problem became too big to ignore, and so conversation had to take place? Or kind of how did that progress?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, in the early 90s, there were a lot of churches, including in Africa and here, that didn't want to talk about it. I mean, some Christians believed that it was a form of punishment, and yet when you spend time in Africa, many of your listeners have. I've lived there for a number of years, and you listen to the stories of children, of moms who really are victims of HIV and AIDS, you start to begin to see a different story. So some of my colleagues way back in the late 80s just started listening and talking to pastors, listening to communities that were affected by HIV and AIDS, and they started to tell the story and basically ask the question, what would Jesus do? Is this not the leprosy of our day? And it's complicated because of the transmission and how it's transmitted and biologically, sexually, and all of that. But so much, you know, the 40 million orphans as a result of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa alone, all of them were innocent and victims. So the church stood up and rose to do amazing things, and not just in Africa, but here in the United States as well, globally. And we saw major progress on a disease that was, you know, some say was going to wipe out, you know, whole nations, whole communities. So, you know, thank God for the church and God's design and how he's called us to serve our brother, sister, who are vulnerable, who are in need.
So progress has been made, of course, in many areas in fights against global poverty and health and things, but obviously still work to be done. Are there specifically maybe some big areas of challenge that World Relief still is looking at trying to tackle and get a hold of?
Yeah, so you're right, Neil. On one hand, there's been major progress. You have about half as many people in what we call absolute poverty or extreme poverty, which is, you know, less than about $1.50 a day, you know, really having a hard time surviving. The number of people in that category has dropped in half. You mentioned children. The number of children that survive after the age of five used to be upwards of 40,000 would die each day from things that are very simple to fix. In fact, Bono, the singer from U2, called it stupid poverty. It's things like malaria. It's things like, you know, just basic hunger issues that we know how to fix. And those kids, 40,000 a day were dying. Now it's about 20,000 kids. So you celebrate the progress, right? But then you quickly realize there's still 20,000 kids dying each day that shouldn't be dying, right? And these are innocent children. So there's much more to do on the front of hunger, even on the front of malaria. And then there's other complex issues like, you know, child trafficking, human trafficking, sex trafficking that are plaguing nations. And then there are whole countries that we call fragile states that, though there's progress in more stable countries, those countries that are at war, civil war, like, you know, the Congo or South Sudan now is going through major problems where upwards of half the population is at risk of starvation. Why? That's because the countries are falling apart from war, civil tension. And another country like that is Yemen up in the Arabian Peninsula. So we're focused on some of those countries and calling the church to take notice, to pray for these nations, to do what they can to talk to their friends and family about how we might serve and help people who are in a real dire situations.
I'm curious, Stephen, if when it comes to changing maybe behavior or practices and policies, does that happen from the maybe top levels of government, or does it have to come up from sort of the one family at a time, from the bottom up? I guess I'd think about maybe our views, whether we're understand a lot about sub-Saharan Africa or not. We assume that maybe the governments don't always run so effectively and efficiently. So are there sticking points that you have to work around that maybe you wouldn't have to if you're working here in the U.S.?
That's such a great insight, Neil. The problems of poverty are very complex, right? And if anyone ever talks about a single solution to poverty, generally they're wrong, and we should question that. And yet at the same time, when there's a lack of water in a community, yes, they need water. They may need a borehole well or some sort of rain catchment system to convert rainwater into drinking water. And those are good solutions. But if at the same time you're not talking about how to bolster the local economy or bring the community together, and if you're not talking about values and what's important in terms of how we see one another and cutting across some of the tensions. And then also, as you've alluded to, Neil, if we're not thinking at more of a larger level, from the government perspective, the nation's leaders, if you're not thinking about who are those leaders and corruption. So I like to talk about poverty as a complex problem that requires a comprehensive solution. Now, we're not all gifted or called to take on the whole picture, but we need to take on what we're called to do, whether that's solving a water problem or helping children go to school. But we have to do those things mindful of the other actors that are playing a very important role. Somebody really needs to be working on the policy level with government. Who are the leaders and who's working on better democracy in certain countries? So all of it comes together. And an organization like World Relief, my colleagues there, many other organizations, IJM does great work in sex trafficking. When they work in a community, they work in tandem with other players that are trying to fix the whole piece. Because the worst thing in the world would be if you put a borehole well in a community and a family or a group of families or a whole village has access to water, but it only lasts for a short time because something changes or something happens. There's a war that springs up, or dads and moms aren't able to earn some income to bring food home to the families. So that happens a lot, is we take on a single solution hoping that will solve the problem, but then it's undermined by something else. So focus on a single solution, that's all good, but do it mindful of all the other players that need to play an important role in solving the problems for the long term.
We'll talk more about it in a moment with Stephen Bowen, because he talks a lot about looking at solutions in terms of relationships rather than tactics and strategies. And we're going to talk more about some of the challenges that remain in our world today, World Global AIDS Day. We're also going to focus on the Syrian refugee crisis, of which it is significant. Stephen Bowen has co-authored with Matthew Sorens and Dr. Issam Smir, Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. We do have some copies of that we're going to give away here at the top of the hour. So you're welcome to sign up for that and find it a very helpful, practical book to apply some strategies to and the heart for reaching out in Jesus' name. You can join us. Sign up for that at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Stephen has also written Possible, a Blueprint for Changing How We Change the World. We'll talk a little bit about that as well coming up. Stephen Bowman is president and CEO of World Relief, and they're a church-based international relief and development agency. And we'll talk more about the importance of that connection with the church. Also want to get Stephen's story, find out a little bit about his journey from rural Wisconsin to heading at World Relief. And maybe we can draw some lessons from that as well. More just ahead with Stephen Bowman from World Relief here on Connecting Faith. Talking today with Stephen Bauman, president of one of the largest relief organizations in the world, and he believes that true change begins in the hearts and actions of ordinary people. Stephen's president and CEO of World Relief. It's a church-based international relief and development agency and doing great work in countries around the world, some 20 countries at least, and they work in areas of health, economics, agriculture, and refugee assistance. Stephen, your home area is Wisconsin. How did you talk about your journey to CEO World Relief? And was in doing acts of kind of compassion, caring for the poor, was that something that stirred in your heart at a young age?
Absolutely. You know, actually not, Neil. I wasn't interested. I was a prodigal son. And I had an experience with God where he just ambushed me, and I became a follower of Jesus through a radical set of circumstances at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And through a long story, met my wife, Belinda, and she was the one who would, after we got married, she said, Stephen, we need to go and volunteer, do something, you know, for God. And I said, oh, that sounds great. We were all committed and going to church. And I said, how about we jump in with the youth group? And she said, I was thinking of going to Africa. I said, oh, wow, that's a big step. I said, maybe next year. Well, I said maybe next year for 3 years. And finally I said, I was in business at the time and in a consulting practice. I said, you know, there's a window of time I could take some months out. Maybe we could go and volunteer for a few months. And so we did. We went across the ocean to sub-Saharan Africa with a group called Mercy Ships, and we intended to go for 6 months, and we not only fell in love with the country of Africa, or the continent of Africa, but we learned that you know, people like me as a strategist, a business person, a leader, and Belinda, an educator, there was a huge need for us in, you know, some of the great crises of the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa at the time. So we ended up staying for 6 years and really changed the focus of our careers, although I will say to this day that so much of what I learned in business I applied then and still do every day. And in terms of leadership and strategy and administration, and so much of that is just so important in the ministry world. I think it's often underestimated by those working day to day and doing great work in business and organizations and so on. So we stayed for 6 years in sub-Saharan Africa, came back, did some study at Wheaton College, and had two children, Joshua and Caleb, and then we moved out to Washington, D.C., and got connected with an organization that was a partner to World Relief. And then our two kids were age 3 and 5. We wanted to go back to Africa. We wanted them to experience what we had experienced in some of the countries we lived. And so a friend of ours at World Belief said, why don't you go to Rwanda? World Belief needs a leader there. And so we went off to Rwanda, flew into the country, never been there before, with the intention of staying 5 or 6 years, and led an incredible team. My colleagues at World Belief still doing just great things in Rwanda. We were there for just 2 years when World Belief asked me to come back and lead their overall program portfolio. So we moved back to the Washington, D.C. area and did that for a few years, and then the board asked me to candidate to be the CEO, and did that for 6 years. And Neil, since we've spoken, I've transitioned from World Belief, handed it off to two really great colleagues, and now working on behalf of a number of philanthropists, people who are giving to not only World Belief but many other organizations. So now I'm a partner again to World Belief, and happy to commend them, but still working in the same world of how do we connect, you know, faith, action to the great needs of the world, including Africa and other parts. So it's just a great privilege. It's been a great journey.
Thanks for sharing your story, and hopefully it will encourage others. I'm interested. You talked about how your skills and training in strategy and planning those things, and yet I know that in your book, Possible, Blueprint for Changing How We Change the World, you talk a lot in terms of relationships. Say a bit more about that. You know, we need those sort of hard skills, but I guess soft skills as well.
Yeah, well said. And then, you know, the book's titled Possible for several reasons. One is it's a reminder of how much is getting better. So often we turn on the evening news or flip open the newspaper, you know, our phones, and look and scroll through the headlines, and you know, it's easy to get depressed, right? And yet, I go out to these places, and some of the hardest places in the world. And in fact, I was I was just near one of the worst wars that were, you know, it's a bit of a delicate country, but I was just near a country. I was in the country for just a little bit, but it's very dangerous there. And the people are suffering significantly, but at the same time, we're seeing an amazing amount of people choosing to follow Jesus Christ. So, it's a paradox of great suffering, but at the same time, great change. And so my vantage point, and many others, many of your listeners have met and seen things that would say a very different story than what we hear in the news. Change is happening. It is possible to see things change. But the other reason why I titled the book Possible is actually more personal. And it's a bit of my own story and the story of so many hundreds and thousands of people that I've met who got connected in ways and have been able to contribute and lend their strengths, their passion. Many of them have never left their day-to-day careers or calling or job, but they're involved somehow in some issue of the world. And so back to your question about relationships, I like to tell people to think of, you know, three things and where three areas of their lives intersect is probably where God is calling you into, you know, lending your hand, your strength, your passion, your prayers, your giving to some problem in the world. And you know, one of those areas is just our experience. You know, what where we have gained competency and where we have gained wisdom. And, I mean, that's not just, you know, formal education, but it's things that we've learned along the way. It could be things that, you know, a trade. It could be the arts. It could be, just knowledge and wisdom that you've picked up on your own, the school of hard knocks even. So that wisdom. And then the second category is that passion. What really brings you alive, that really gets you passionate. And one of the ways to figure out whether you're passionate about something is to ask yourself, what really drives you crazy and makes you upset, right? And, you know, in the Bible, there's these psalms that are about being upset. They're laments. And if there's something in the world that you hear about and you just drives you to a righteous anger, that is kind of the flip side of passion, and it may be something God is calling you to through a very interesting way, right? Something that bothers you. So that wisdom, that passion, where those two intersect. And then the third question I like to encourage people to consider.
Well, Stephen, we're going to make this a tease to stick around. We've got a hard break coming up here. So we've talked to two out of three things that God uses to develop us. You have to stick around for 2 minutes to find out that third thing with Stephen Bauman, who's partnering with World Relief, served as president and CEO for a number of years, with us today here on Connecting Faith. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. World AIDS Day, a day to advocate for ways to reduce this disease that still affects over 30 and nearly 40 million people who live with HIV/AIDS. Also, challenges in our world in terms of global hunger and poverty and injustice, wars causing huge refugee issues. We're talking about it today with Stephen Bauman. Stephen served as President and CEO of World Relief for a number of years. It's a church-based international relief and development agency. He's partnering with World Relief now in very strategic ministry to help see funding take place for these wonderful ministries that are making such a difference. And we're talking about, you know, how we might find our way in service. And when we last left off, Stephen was giving us three things that we should reflect on. We talked about experience. Number two was passion. And we're waiting on number three, Stephen.
Yeah, thank you, Neil. It's that, you know, the experience, what we have wisdom in. Secondly, where we're passionate, where we're excited. And thirdly, where our relationships are, people that we know. And we'd be surprised if you make a list of the people that you know, from your local community to your church to school to your workplace across the world, and when you start to bring those three areas together, wisdom, I'll call it experience, passion, what you really get excited about, and your network of relationships, the intersection of those three things is often very surprising. And if people, I encourage people to do a little work on that, draw a picture, make some notes, and you'd be surprised what you find out and where you're already connected and where you might be helpful in solving some of the world's greatest problems. The other thing that I like to encourage people to do is pick one thing. Once you kind of zero in on something, whether it's, you know, water solutions in a part of the world or trafficking, or maybe it's the refugee issue, which is very complicated, right? But once you choose one thing and you feel passionate about it, you have some experience that you might be able to lend, and you have a network of relationships, even if it's just one set of relationships that connects you to that world, I encourage people to stay with it for a long time. You know, spend a lifetime in it. Spend a couple of years focusing on that issue. Learn about it. Meet people who are working on the same thing. Listen to the nonprofit leaders that are working in that space. You'd be surprised how God leads us all. Generally, all of us feel like there's nothing we can do. Take a small step. Think about what God has led you already and start to connect with some people. Listen and learn over not just a few weeks, not even just a few months, but, you know, into the years and more. And that's where surprising things happen. People who felt like there's nothing I can do suddenly are able to say, wow, I'm able to do something really meaningful that has helped these people in this part of the world or in my own community. I've heard those stories so many times, and it got me so excited. That's why I wrote the book. It was a book not to just talk about, you know, what's happening in the world, but actually it's a book about people, about you, about your listeners, and how they can step in with both feet, confident that they can actually, you know, fulfill God's calling without necessarily ever changing their job or their career or going to school, but leveraging and leaning into, you know, desires, passion, experience, and friendships.
And we need one another, because oftentimes when God kind of awakens us, the next step is maybe down, not up. And so we do need that support from others to keep a long-term perspective, don't we?
So true, very true, Neil. I think I could have said it better. That sometimes it's not the big grandiose vision, but it's, you know, it's the apartment building, you know, a couple blocks away, where you maybe have met some friends of friends that are hosting a meal for, you know, some Sudanese people that are new in town, and that kind of, you know, potluck lunch, they're dangerous because they can change your lives and change the lives of others.
Speaking of those that have great needs, we, of course, continue to hear about war in Syria, and that seems to be kind of the focal point for the refugees. So many are struggling, lost their homes, and living in terrible conditions. Give us a sense of what's happening in the refugee crisis. I know you've been part of writing about and working with refugees. What's the best thing we can do there?
Yeah, it's such an important topic, and I think it's important first to put ourselves in the shoes of a mom or a dad or a brother or a sister in Syria. When you wake up in the morning and you're hearing the bombs coming closer and closer to your village. And in fact, there was a young, I think she was 10 years old, who was tweeting from her village in Aleppo, Syria. And, you know, a lot of us who were following her got a real close-up view of a young girl who was basically afraid to go to bed at night, wondering if there would be a bomb dropped on her house. And just recently they were able to leave and had to leave. They had to flee. But it's important to understand the Syrian crisis or issue from the eyes or the perspective of a Syrian family. And I met them, and, you know, I talked to moms and dads, and some of them are now in Jordan and neighboring countries like Lebanon, and, you know, they've kept their house keys, and some of them have lost their houses. Like, their whole villages and streets are blown up and in rubble and shambles. But they've kept their house keys because they really do want to go back home. And people don't want to necessarily come to the United States or to Europe, but they have no other choice. They're desperate, and it's dangerous, or they've lost loved ones back in their home country. And so the program that the United States has led for many years, all the way back to the Reagan days when we were accepting far more refugees than we do today, It's the United States Refugee Program, and it's the legacy of our country to reach out to those who are suffering. And if you, you know, if you know, have you seen the Statue of Liberty? You know, there's a plaque there that says, "Give us your tired masses, the people who are suffering." And we've always been that kind of a nation, and we're not a nation that takes, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees. We take less than 0.5% of the world's refugees, so it's a modest number. That number has been shrinking over the years, and I mentioned Ronald Reagan. He had a robust vision for refugees, and the program then and still now vets and spends actually several years before they admit refugees into our country. So there's a lot of precautions taken, more than any other way to come to the United States. There's a lot of misunderstanding on that front. So we are seeing some Syrian refugees come to the United States, not many, because like I mentioned, it's a 2 or 3 year process of interviews and vetting and background checks, security checks, retina scans, health checks before those families can come to the United States. Now, we've also seen, you know, your question about what we can do. We've seen churches across the United States being willing to reach out to those families as they come legally through the United States program and system, and organizations like World Belief help bring them to the United States, teach them English, help them find jobs and jobs that other people don't want to take, frankly, and they're willing to take them. And many of the business owners and leaders that I meet across the nation are really excited about refugees taking positions that they haven't been able to fill, and those same people stay in those positions for years and help those businesses and those communities thrive. There's some really good data on that. Churches are often are the best ways to welcome these families with not necessarily hosting them in their houses. We set them up in apartments, but just reaching out to them with meals and maybe joining some groups to teach English. We've seen incredible things by churches in the United States, and we've also seen those churches and those people and those families that have taken a step to be a good neighbor team, for example. Just join a team to reach out to a refugee family for, you know, maybe it's one night a month. Those people will say, my life has changed. It's better because I've met this family. And for people who are interested and really concretely want to get involved, you can go to World Belief's website, worldbelief.org, and there's a list of cities where World Belief has offices, and you can connect with one of those offices and say, hey, can I meet a refugee family and can I get involved? And is my, you know, you can ask your church, your leaders, if your church is involved in refugee resettlement. But it's an awesome way. I mean, it's an incredible way to be the hands and feet of Jesus to people who are fleeing situations of violence that, you know, it's just hard to conceive. But when they are welcomed by an American, even if it's just a smile because we don't speak the language perfectly or they don't speak English yet, it means the world, and it really is Jesus in the flesh.
I want to encourage people to check out Stephen as one of the co-authors of the book Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, or and you can go to worldrelief.org to find out how you can get plugged in. Stephen Bauman served as president and CEO of World Relief for a number of years and is partnering with them in the ministry that's helping to fund these great outreaches. Stephen, it's good to get caught up with you again, and blessings on you in the days ahead.
Hey, thank you so much, Neil, and greetings and Merry Christmas to all your listeners. And let's not forget as we go into the Christmas season that Jesus himself was a refugee, so we can love him better by loving our brothers and sisters who have come from very difficult places.
Amen. Stephen Bauman joining us today on Connecting Faith. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about an outreach to Cuba, particularly in light of Castro's passing. Transworld Radio has been sharing the gospel in Cuba for many years and all across the Caribbean, around the world. We're going to hear about one of their increased outreach opportunities in just a minute.
Communists never Christmas. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. After his takeover in 1959, the late Cuban dictator Fidel Castro declared his government officially atheist. 10 years later, he outlawed Christmas so it wouldn't get in the way of the sugarcane harvest. Christmas trees and Santa Claus were banned as too Christian and too American. Castro only lifted the prohibition on Christmas in 1997 for Pope John Paul II's visit. As I said on Breakpoint, communist Cuba remains one of the failed utopian visions in which the state replaces God. Remember the other dictator who outlawed Christmas? The White Witch ruled C.S. Lewis's Narnia for twice as long as Castro and kept it always winter but never Christmas. She feared the one whom Christmas represented. But with Aslan on the move, her false claim to power began to melt. And down in sunny Cuba, Castro's death marks the end of a dark chapter. But Cuba needs our prayers to escape the utopian fantasy of communism and for a Merry Christmas. I'm John Stone Street.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. You know, with the passing of Fidel Castro, Cuba has come on the front pages once again, and there's renewed interest in this nation that has lived under communist rule for so many years. Despite the restrictions on freedom in Cuba, the gospel has been reaching this nation through radio. And we're going to talk about it today with Lauren Libby, president and CEO of Trans World Radio. Trans World Radio reaches into over 160 countries and broadcasts in over 100 languages. And Lauren, welcome to Connecting Faith. I know Trans World Radio has had an interest in Cuba for many years.
Well, actually, yes. We've been broadcasting into Cuba now almost 50 years, and it's a very interesting place. It's a complicated place, but it's a place that's very open spiritually. And now with the death of Fidel Castro, there's a whole new dynamic on the island and a lot of uncertainty because, you know, people really aren't sure what the future holds, and it's a great time as people begin to evaluate their own futures in light of that and the uncertainties on the island. And it's a prime time to be ministering in Cuba.
And we don't hear the full picture of life in Cuba, but for those living under a dictatorship, I mean, the freedom of religion and many other freedoms and economic freedom is certainly not the case there, is it?
That is very true. However, it's interesting to note that the church is growing very, very quickly in Cuba. In fact, I was with some people about a year ago who had planted 200 new house churches, and the gospel is moving very, very quickly on the island. And it's interesting to note that when there is persecution and when the gospel is restricted, a lot of times that's when the gospel moves the quickest.
Talk about the kind of programming and how you're reaching into Cuba and really all the Caribbean through an amazing signal out of Bonaire.
Well, Cuba is 11 million people, and we speak to Cuba every night, and we get several thousand responses back out of there on a monthly basis. It's incredible how hungry people are to hear particularly good teaching. When the gospel's moving that quickly in an environment and in a culture, a lot of times there's a time lag on good doctrine and a time lag on good biblical teaching. And so for a lot of the people who are leading these little house churches, they listen to TWR Bonaire to be able to get instruction, to be able to be equipped in theology, to be able to be equipped in how to share the Word of God. And in fact, I was in a meeting one time, and they started the meeting, and they said, "Good evening, this is Trans World Radio Bonaire." And they thought that's the way that you would actually start a message, because they'd listened to that for so long, and they'd listened to the biblical teaching, and now this person was teaching, and so he just taught what he'd heard.
Well, Lauren, I know that Trans World Radio Bonaire, you've been in the midst of a upgrade project there for several years. Just give us an update on that and what will happen when that the new power increase is fully implemented.
The biggest power allowed in the United States is 50,000 watts on the AM band. The new Bonaire station will be 450,000 watts. And the reason we're doing that is to more effectively cover the island of Cuba and also Venezuela and down into northern Brazil at night when AM radio really stretches out. And we're in the middle of this upgrade project. All the work has been completed. Now we're finishing raising the funds for the transmitter. And we're about ready to order the transmitter, and Lord willing, about halfway through the year next year, we'll be on the air with 450,000 watts, and people will be able to hear much, much better on the island. In addition, we're beaming that signal right on Havana, and so we're looking to minister to the body of Christ in Cuba in a much better way. And we're doing this in response to actually people on the island saying, you're not as strong as you used to be. We used to be at 500,000 watts, then we went down to 100,000 watts, and with new technology, we're able to go back to the high power again and do it for about the same amount of money as on the 100,000 watts. So we're very encouraged with the technology and with the opportunity, and if the Lord provides the funds between now and next April, we'll be on the air, Lord willing, about July or August, with a much better signal into Cuba.
The effectiveness of radio, we're kind of into all sorts of media platforms here in the U.S. these days, but radio, and even as you said, AM radio, is still amazingly effective, isn't it, around the globe?
Well, it is. It's amazing how many people listen. You stop and think about the 11 million people on the island of Cuba, and every night you can talk to all those 11 million. Now, do those 11 million listen? Well, obviously not, but it's a way that we can communicate clearly with no restrictions, with no political restrictions, with no restrictions at all, and go directly into a person's home. Whereas with the Internet, if we do that with the Internet, governments can control the content. They can actually shut the Internet down and control the Internet. And plus, it's an experience that can be traced directly to the individual that's clicking on the Internet. So radio is a very effective tool, particularly in more restricted environments. Now, the digital means is growing as well globally, and we're in the middle of that as well, Neil.
Well, in fact, I know that Faith Radio is part of your global online delivery. There's a number of stations and formats that are on there. Just say a bit about that amazing new platform that you're sharing the gospel with in some pretty exciting ways.
Well, if you happen to have a smartphone and you're listening this morning, you can download the TWR app at the TWR store, the Android store. Just simply look for TWR 360, TWR 360, and download the app. There is all kinds of content there. You can listen to Faith Radio. In fact, Neil, I've listened to Faith Radio in Bulgaria on my cell phone. I was actually listening one morning. Actually, it was in the afternoon in Bulgaria, and I was listening to the morning programming on Faith Radio. You know, it's an exciting time to be in media because a lot of these new platforms that are coming out. I must say, though, that still when you look at the cost effectiveness of reaching people and the ability to reach the most people, the radio platform, the RF platform, is still the most economical one. Because on a per-person basis, it's a lot less expensive than doing it digitally. Because if you had, suppose, 1 million people listening digitally, we'll have about 12 million people listen this year on our TWR 360 app, listening at Faith Radio and other programming. But then you look at how many people you can reach in one night by radio. Under the TWR transmitters, there are about 3.8 billion people. And if just 1% listen, I mean, you put that up against 10 million, it's obvious that the on-the-air presence is far more pervasive even than digital at this point.
Lauren, as we head into the new year, what prayer requests would you invite us to partner with you in praying about? Obviously, Bonaire, that upgrade project, but how can we pray for the ongoing effectiveness of Transworld?
Well, let me give you three prayer requests. First of all, is Cuba that will be able to finish the project and be able to minister to people on the island effectively and clearly. The second thing is, as we're beginning to move into the Muslim world and concentrate on that part of the world, that God would give us real wisdom and a sense of grace as we move into that arena to minister, and there are a number of projects we have going on in that part of the world, and we're very encouraged with the response, and God is doing a lot of things, well, in some cases supernaturally, in the whole 1040 window. And the number three thing would be just to for courage and faith to move forward. Sometimes we move into projects and, you know, the funding, not only the funding, but the people, and you just walk into it by faith and ask God to provide. And we've been amazed over the last 8 years to see what God's done in terms of providing the people and providing the resources necessary to reach others with the good news of Jesus.
You want to find out more about the great work of Transworld Radio? We appreciate our partnership with Transworld, twr.org, and check out the TWR360 app as well on your smartphone. Lauren Libby, President and CEO of Transworld Radio. Blessings to you, Lauren. Thanks for the update today.
Well, thank you, Neil, and blessings to the Faith Radio family.
Amazing, Ted, isn't it? 450,000 watts.
That's powerful.
That is, yeah, they're going to... They're going to blanket more than Havana once they get that
incredible
going. So, great opportunity. Hey, speaking of opportunity, great opportunity during this month of December as we partner with Angel Tree. It's a ministry of prison fellowship. And your gift, $99, is going to help reach six children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parent. I want to just encourage you to consider what you might be able to do in supporting this great outreach.
Opening it, we were so amazed seeing as these presents were from my father.
And so we walk up to the door and explain to her who we were. And as I'm doing that, from the back of the room, I hear this little voice go, I knew my daddy wouldn't forget me.
People don't even know me. I'm in prison. Why would anybody care about me and my kids?
Christmas just wasn't an option had it not been for Angel Tree.
The big wall of bars starts to open. Chad runs over and he starts hollering, I've got a daddy. I've got a daddy.
I was scared about Christmas without my dad, but not anymore.
My daddy, I love you.
I love you, Mom.
I want to wish him a happy Christmas.
This came from my dad. How did he know what I wanted?
When you get out of jail, be good and don't get on the streets no more.
Hi, Dad. I miss you, and I hope you miss me. Your son. Bye.
2.7 million children. We'll spend the holidays separated from their incarcerated parents. And Angel Tree is a program of prison fellowship that serves parents behind bars by equipping the church to share the love of Jesus with their children and families. And they mobilize the church to minister to hundreds of thousands of children. We're asking you to consider your part in that. $99 will reach six children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their parent in prison. So, and you can make your gift online at angeltree.org, angeltree.org. Or if you go to our website, myfaithradio.com, you'll find a link right there in the front page. I encourage you to do that.
The first thing you'll see, myfaithradio.com. Look for the Angel Tree link right there.
All right. Special outreach during this month of December. We so appreciate your generosity in this area. By the way, tomorrow we're going to be talking Angel Tree. You'll hear more of the stories. You're going to hear from actually two field directors for Prison Fellowship, and they're going to tell stories of changing the lives of children with a parent in prison. We can do something to make a difference. You can find out more on tomorrow's Connecting Faith. You'll hear some powerful stories as well of those that have benefited from this mercy ministry. So check it out tomorrow, Joe Bender on Connecting Faith. If you missed a part of today's show or any of the others that you maybe heard parts of, but you want to listen to again or pass on to a friend, you can find all those podcasts available. The interviews are all posted on our website, myfaithradio.com, and then go to the Connecting Faith show page, myfaithradio.com, and click on Connecting Faith.
And if you're a new listener, we want to send you a free welcome packet. Find that at myfaithradio.com. It's also on our main page. We'll send that to you for free, myfaithradio.com.
Thanks for joining us today on Connecting Faith.